Hey, welcome back to another Made for TV Mayhem show. I wish I had something funny and witty to say, but tonight has been nothing close to being funny or witty for us. We're having a lot of technical issues. So we're getting kind of a late start and we're feeling a little frazzled, but we are so excited to talk about these two movies. So the whole reason why I picked Death Cruise from 1974 and Cruise into Terror from 1978 was because summer's coming and I thought we could take a vacation together. I didn't know that a vacation, though, would involve dealing with Skype. That ended up being a thing. So we're having a real difficult time. So the cruises that we're taking are pre-internet. So we're going to calm down. We're going to dial it back. We're going to go back to the 70s and we're going to watch people get killed on boats. And I can't imagine anything better than that. So let's just get started before I start throwing things out the window. Okay, I'm here with both my co-hosts tonight. So I'm super excited about that. So let's start by saying hello to Nate. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I am. You might not want to ask that question because
Oh,
if I
that's
say,
true because I was around for the pre-show.
if I say okay, I'll be lying, and I hate lying, especially to you, Nate, because you're so
Oh.
good. You're so good. It makes me feel bad.
Well, thank you.
So okay, and I'm also here with Dan, although I think Dan's only half here. Dan.
I apologize, folks. I'm a little under the weather today, but I am ready. I am ready to take a cruise. They gave me that little drink you have that calms your stomach before you go on board. So I think I'm going to be ship shape for the next couple hours.
Okay, so it hasn't gone online yet, I don't think, but I recorded Hysteria Continues for Jacko with the gang, and we kept talking about what a shit pickle episode it was because there were so many problems, and I think we're having our own shit pickle here, and it's devastating me, guys. It's devastating me. So, okay, so the only person here who's of his right mind is Nate. So, and I don't know what that means. So let's just move ahead. I guess we'll just dive right into the movies. I don't think there's much to say. There's no housekeeping or anything. So, Dan, why don't you tell us a little bit about Death Cruise?
Alrighty, now I will. Before I begin, I will point out that if you've listened to previous episodes, you know that the larger the ensemble cast, the more I tend to get lost about halfway during my description. So I'm going to try to keep this as absolutely straightforward as I can. Fingers crossed. It's a cruise! Hooray! We're in Long Beach or something like that. Are we in Long Beach? No, we're in the Gulf of
We're
Mexico.
in Richard Long Beach. Richard Long Beach, guys. Also,
Da-da.
when you get just real quick, when you get to the captain, you're gonna want to say Cesar de Nova, but it's Cesare.
Is it?
Okay?
Wow.
I believe so.
I was just going to say the captain with the accent, but Cesare,
Oh,
I'm
okay,
going to
that's
have to
why
write that
too.
down. Cesare, Cesare. So the cruise begins, and it's a lovely cruise. It's a big cruise on a huge ship, classic cruise, and you meet three couples. You meet the Carters, Sylvia Carter, Polly Bergen, Jerry Carter, Richard Long. Jerry is he's an insurance salesman, and he thinks about money a lot, and he is, according to his wife, a bit of a scoundrel. And he looks at the ladies a lot and generally ends up leaving her kind of like sitting in the cabin, sad. And then we have Kate Jackson is Mary Frances Radney, and Edward Albert as James Radney. They have been married 2 or 3 years. This is their second honeymoon. They're a sweet couple. They don't have any kids. It's Kate Jackson. It's Eddie Albert's son. I know. It's Edward Albert, and they're charming. And then the third couple is the Masons, Elizabeth and David, Celeste Holm and Tom Bosley, for heaven's sake. They've been married, I want to say they're married for 31 years, I believe, and the last 25 have been raising kids, and now they've got an empty nest and they're going on a cruise. And David is very much of the, let's have a good time. The kids are gone, where she is very much like she's constantly thinking about the kids. We also meet Dr. Burke, the ship's doctor, who is just there for one, just there for this cruise. That's Michael Constantine. And then we meet the captain, who's played by Cesare? Cesare.
Cesare de
Cesare de
Nova.
Nova, yes. And so they're all on there, and it's all great. And we meet these three couples. They have one of those things where, like, sit with a member of the crew at dinner. Everyone sits down with the ship's doctor, Dr. Burke. Jerry Carter isn't there yet, but Jerry Carter shows up, and we learn something interesting. We learn that basically all three of these couples have won the cruise through some place called E&M Promotions. Jerry arrives, and things get kind of interesting. I say kind of interesting. They actually get pretty darn interesting, if you'll forgive me. So everyone's kind of like, huh? What's going on? What? We're all here.
You know what this scene reminds me of? Even though this isn't a supernatural film, and that's no spoiler, Haunts of the Very Rich is actually like this as well. Oh, yeah. You know, where they all kind of wind up somewhere and they don't know how they got there. And I think they won a contest, right? To island.
I want to say yes on that, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So they're all there and it's like, hey, we're all here and we're having a good time. And so we kind of see them all hanging out and doing their thing. And then, oh boy, trouble. Jerry is possibly going to meet with a young lady during the evening, and he is kind of like on the deck on the railing, kind of looking out at the ocean in the middle of the night, and then suddenly he's gone, and they find his like cigarette case or cigarette lighter or an item that belongs to him, and it's like, oh my God, he fell overboard, he's dead. Was it an accident? Did he fall or was he pushed? Oh, wait a minute, that's not right. But you know what I mean. And so Jerry's like, what? Jerry's gone. And Sylvia's sort of, you know, like, oh, he's gone. But, yeah, he was kind of a jerk, even if he was Richard Long.
You know, there's a scene here where they're talking about him falling off the boat. Kate Jackson says to her husband about how horrible it must have been to see the boat getting smaller and smaller. That really is disturbing. Yeah. Like that piece of dialogue. And so she's setting up like what it must be like to fall off a boat. And I'm like, wow, this really took a turn.
It does. Cause she says something like, you know, to call for help and just watch the ship get smaller and smaller, which is especially in the dark when you know that there's probably no one looking, maybe? I don't know, maybe. Dr. Burke does do a lot of stuff in this, so possibly he was looking. So what happens is we lose him. The group begins to begin to have some troubles. Obviously, Sylvia is kind of heartbroken-ish about the loss of her husband. And the Radneys begin to discuss kids. He doesn't want them. She does. And at this point, we learn that Kate Jackson is a crack shot with a rifle. You know, the
pulse. Yes, right.
She reminded me of the woman from The Redeemer, who you first see with her shotgun.
Yes. Pulp.
And then we also have the Masons. And Mr. Mason has kind of said to his wife, you know, if all this is going to be about is our kids, then maybe we should end this. Then he finds her drinking. She kind of gets her own back.
Well, I mean, he's such a jerk to her. Like, he's not very sympathetic to it because basically she's a housewife. And she says this to him. She's like, you know, you get your job and you get to get up every day and have purpose. And I was the caretaker and the chauffeur and this and that. And now I don't have that anymore. Mm-hmm. And he's like a douchebag about it. I can't think of a better word for that.
Yes, and she does. I will say this at the end of that scene where she kind of balls him out and he leaves. She kind of is like, oh, I went a little too far, and she kind of looks out and kind of yells for him. But as she yells for him, we also see a very strange old gentleman who's been popping up throughout the movie, who is very Very suspicious looking, and is constantly like talking to Dr. Martin, saying Dr. Burke, I'm sorry, saying stuff like, you know, have you got all my medical records? Have you got this, that, and the other? So as this is going on, and spoiler, as more people begin to die in this group, we begin to see a little bit more of this creepy old guy, and Dr. Burke begins to sort of take command, and things kind of build, and a few more people are killed, and there's a scene where they are all assembled. Basically, the captain and the doctor cotton to the fact that these six people are being killed, so they bring the remaining ones into a room, and they sit them all down, and they have this discussion.
You know, it's not in the clip, but also right before they start to talk about, like, how they've been targeted to be murdered, Edward Albert talks about how the refrigerator must be getting full of bodies.
Yes.
And that struck me, too. I was like, you know, for a movie that felt so light when it started, it's like, you know, it's not like you see anything super gory or anything, but it's just, I guess I used the word before, but it's dark. I can't think of another word to say it. Yeah. Like, the language between everybody is really dark.
Yeah, and there's the moment where Tom Bosley basically, where Kate Jackson comes up to him and says, "Hey, Mr. C, how you doing?" No, she doesn't say that. She says, "Mr. Mason, how you doing?" And he says, "They're keeping her in the fridge. They're keeping my
That's
wife's
right.
body in the fridge." And it's just like, he says it, and you almost want to hear a bit of laugh track. You hope you hear some laugh track, but you don't, which makes it even darker, I think. So at this point, there are a few survivors left. Someone is killing these six people. It has something apparently to do with Atlanta in 1970, but no one can quite figure out what the link is. And Dr. Burke is on top of it, trying to find out what E&M promotions are, possibly trying to find out who this strange older gentleman is. And I'll just stop my plot synopsis right here. It might get bad for the survivors, or it might not.
So I just thought of this while you were doing the plot synopsis, and so maybe we'll spoil it here. So if you haven't seen Death Cruise, I recommend that you don't listen to the rest of this, because I don't think it's a great mystery, but I do think it's one where you probably want to watch not knowing how it ends, because it does have its own thing going on there that's a surprise, and it's convoluted. But as you were talking, Dan, it occurred to me that in a way I think that this movie is to a degree like Friday the 13th, in that it's an unsolvable crime, and not completely unsolvable, but when you find out who the culprit is, it's pretty obvious who the old guy on the boat is, and so I'm just going to tell you, it's Jerry. It's Richard Long's character. That's not a surprise. But the thing about Atlanta is fabricated. He works for an insurance company, and basically he's like, I just looked up people, random people, and I just figured out who was all in one place at one time, and then I gathered us all on this boat under the guise that it's a contest, and then said, oh, I must know you from Atlanta, so it looks like that there's some kind of thread happening with all the victims. But really, and actually it's like Fatal Frames, if anybody remembers Fatal Frames, it's like basically like
Fatal Frames.
So it's like I killed a bunch of people so I could kill this one person and just look like a series of murders.
Yes.
And so in a way it's unsolvable, because you know it's Jerry, but then he's got a partner, right? And so the partner is Kate Jackson. And I think it's almost written in a way that it would be impossible to figure everything out because they don't really give you the clues. And instead, at the end, they just reveal everything. So it's kind of a trick in a way, like the way Friday the 13th was a trick. There's no way you could ever figure out who was killing everybody because you don't see her till the end, right? Mm-hmm. So here it's like feeding you a bunch of clues that aren't really ever going to make sense. So if you're piling them away in your head, it doesn't matter because they serve no purpose. But that doesn't necessarily diminish the quality of the film. And actually, to bring up something about the string of murders, if you think about it, so Kate Jackson's trying to get rid of her husband. Richard Long's trying to get rid of his wife. So they've ensnared them in this contest, but then they've also brought in this completely innocent couple, right? The Masons have no attachment to them. And mm-hmm. and they get murdered, right? So they basically just killed this old couple because they're heartless. You know what I mean? It's like kind of a dark film. It's like I keep saying, like really horrible things happen to these people. But so anyway, Dr. Burke like figures everything out and confronts Richard Long on some beautiful beach somewhere, and then stuff happens, and then Kate Jackson appears and she kills Richard Long. And then she acts like she's saving the doctor. And then, you know, the doctor's like, I know you're the killer. And I know we've gone really fast through this and I just spoiled everything. But anyway, that's what happened, guys. And so I've seen Death Cruise before and I remembered that Kate Jackson was the killer. I didn't remember the rest of it. This is a really good movie. I really like it. Something that struck me, and I'll talk about it when I get to the background, is that a lot of the critics pointed out how it was about three dysfunctional marriages. And I hadn't thought of that the first time I watched it. I just thought of it as three couples on a boat getting killed. And it's doing a lot of different things here. So it's kind of critiquing marriage, I guess, in the 70s of different generations, right? There's the couple who've been together for a while. There's a couple who are kind of newlyweds. And then there's the older couple. And none of it's very happy, right? And this is in the age of people splitting up. But it's also a proto-slasher because it's doing things that slashers do. And it's doing things slashers don't do. It's also an Aaron Spelling production, so it's glamorous. It's all Get Out. It's pretty fabulous, especially Polly Bergen's wardrobe. So, like, you were talking about how Richard Long's constantly leaving her alone, but she's always in, like, these two-piece dresses.
Yeah.
And she's, like, in her 40s, and she's fucking working that shit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, she's beautiful. And I'm like, really, Richard Long? Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get it, but anyway, so it's got everything. It's got this Aaron Spelling stamp of glamour. It's got the proto slasher blueprint. It's kind of a dark, weird little film, and I thought it was really good. I really enjoyed it the second time around. Now that I was more in tune to the characters and stuff, it's a really fun movie. I don't think there's a lot of downtime. I think Michael Constantine's really good as Dr. Burke. He's really quite good, and I could see him sort of being a ship doctor who solves crimes like on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Although nobody would ever take that liner after a while. But that would be a really good show, and I would watch it. He's very charming. I really liked it. Dan, what'd you think?
Oh, I quite liked it. Yeah, the only issue I have with it is I think the end does have one twist too many. I think there's just like when you discover that Richard Long, what he's up to, and then Kate Jackson shows up, I just thought that was, I love good twists, I love like getting surprised, but that was one where when it ended I thought, oh, okay, I thought, so wait a minute, one third of those six people was involved in this thing to kill another third? Of that just seems like one person bringing five people there to kill one of them makes sense, but two people bringing four other people there to kill two of them seems a bit much. But I do love the concept that he did kind of just go through all his records just to find, like, Atlanta, 1970, the week. And I love that thing where they just keep, like in the clip, oh, don't I recognize you all? And no, I don't think so. And it's immediately implanted in your brain. That, oh my God, what happened in Atlanta in 1970? Then in the end, it's like, nothing happened in Atlanta in 1970. And I like your point about it being sort of unsolvable, like a lot of sort of giallo and stuff where you can get clues.
Yeah.
You can get all the clues you want, but it isn't until the explanation that it's going to make sense. And whereas a mystery, you should you're going to get people who are like, oh, this person did that because of that kind of thing. And, but you, that doesn't bother me.
You know
me.
What? I'm really glad you said giallo because it probably is more like a giallo, right, than it is well, it's a proto-slasher, but like because it's got the glamour, it makes it's eyeball, right, where they're traveling.
Yes, yes.
And it's unsolvable. That's actually a better comparison than the one I was making to Friday the 13th. I like that better.
Yeah, and everyone is great in it, and I do I really like Michael Constantine as Dr. Burke, because he shows up kind of and he's like, hey, I'm the ship's doctor. Oh, you got to get into your uniform, and then Tom Bosley thinks that he's the captain. He says, no, I'm just the doctor, just stepping in for someone for this cruise. And like halfway through, it's like, why are we calling in the police? Someone or something like that. Well, Dr. Burke is looking into it. Oh, Dr. Burke is looking into it, but he's really good. And he figures it out, which I like because they kind of sneak in a detective into it. You kind of meet him at the beginning, and then about halfway through, you're like, oh, wait a minute. Not only is he a good doctor, but he's kind of a detective too, which is cool. And it kind of adds – it's a lot of elements that you would kind of not really have seen when slashers hit, which is the joy of proto-slashers because you can throw in everything. And it all works, and it's all part of the fun. And you can have Edward Alberts, and Kate Jackson like standing in front of the ocean, just having really emotional scenes mixed with like dead people on lying on steps, and they put her in the fridge, and just all these and that great ending, and it's great to see Richard Long. I spent the first 15 minutes of the movie going, I know that guy. I know that guy. And yeah. I was like, wait a minute. Last year on Eventually Supertrain, Mitchell Hadley and I spent like 20 episodes discussing Bourbon Street Beat. He's the star of Bourbon Street Beat. I was like, I don't know why. He's like 15 years older here. But I don't know why I didn't recognize him. So long. But yeah, I thought it's a joy. If you like and two, it's a 90-minute one, so it's only about 73, 74 minutes. So it kind of gets in, sets it up, does its business, and goes. So I recommend it highly. I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I like the economical approach too. I think it's really well done. Nate, what did you think?
I thought it was like a slasher movie, so that made me very happy.
Good.
Then I guessed the killer wrong, and that made me very sad.
Oh, who did you think it was?
Well, here's the thing. So I thought I was being so clever this whole movie because I was like, E&M Promotions, obviously Elizabeth Mason.
Oh. And I should have figured that out. That's so good.
And so, like, I keep waiting. And then even when she died, I was thinking, okay, it's all right. It's all right. Like, she could have faked it. She faked it. And then at the end, when it was revealed, about Kate Jackson, at the end, I was like, it's looking less and less likely that my guess is correct. I'm like, I just don't see Mrs. Mason standing with a shotgun over the beach and shooting Kate Jackson next, and then the doctor looking up and her looking down and being like, E&M Promotions, baby.
Yes.
Would that not have been a good ending?
Oh my god,
that would have been good. Yeah.
If she had like thrown a card down from the top of the cliff and you saw it float down and hit the ground in front of him and it just said E&M Promotions. And he just looked
perfect.
Down,
and then she just walks off in silence.
Yes.
Oh. You know, and the thing is, Celeste Holm would have been into that. If somebody had approached her with that ending, she would have just embraced it because she was that kind of actress, that she was just so good at everything. Oh, that's so much better than what we got. Now I hate Death Cruise because it doesn't have that ending.
I'm like, that ending would have been fantastic. It would have been amazing for this movie. But as it stands, I still like the movie. I like the characters. I found their relationship dynamics to be kind of interesting. I kind of loved, when Polly Bergen, Sylvia, when she's been informed, that her husband is missing, at first she's just kind of whatever about it. But then when she realized how serious it was, she actually seems to get genuinely upset. Which really she shouldn't have because, he's a killer and he's going to kill her later. But she don't know that at the time.
She doesn't know. Poor Sylvia. That's such a tragic character. She reminds me of the girl in Mother's Day. The one that has the boyfriend that's always doing coke.
Always
and doesn't care about her.
Dismissive.
Yes. And you feel for her because because she's better than that. And you can clearly see that even in Mother's Day, when you don't even know her that well, you can see she's better than what she's living with. And here in the movie, you definitely know that Polly Bergen is better than what she's been saddled with. And so it's really sad when she dies, because honestly, that was her like piece of freedom coming to her. You know what I mean? She was going to have her minute in the sun, and then she didn't get it. And that's kind of, it's just a dark film. Yeah, it's like surprisingly, it's just surprisingly go places. I think it's because you do care about the characters, you know? And even though, like Dan was saying, David Mason can be a little ornery around Elizabeth, but that's just because they're going through something. But he genuinely loves her, you know? So when she died, even though they had had that fight, it was like, it was a fight. It wasn't really like forever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, sad. Yeah, I think just the thing with, if they've spent the last 25 years of their life solely devoted to their kids, and now their kids are gone, he's just moving on into the next stage of their life quicker than she is, and getting annoyed with her. And being on the cruise, I just got the feeling that, he was like, okay, this'll do it. This'll free her up. But it's not, and he should be more understanding, but he's in his space, she's in her space, and then everybody dies. So it's like it's a lot like a great slasher, in that in a good slasher, like a Prom Night, or, and we can argue this one, Final Exam, you like the characters.
Oh, you haven't done that in forever. You haven't slipped that one in forever.
Well, I just because, like, in Final Exam, and some will argue with me, but I think you get to really like the characters. And then in the last half hour, when they all have like their, she's leaving town, she's got her last exam, these guys are going to do some drugs, these guys, they're going here, they're going there, they're doing this, they're doing that, boom, 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 they all get killed one right after the other. It's like, ooh, ugh. And this is kind of like that too. I mean, when you see Edward Albert's character, just his, it's like Kate Jackson steps out into the hallway and his body is just like on the floor, you know, in the hallway. Yes. You know, it's so undignified. He's just like, it's not like he's not in a fun pose or anything like that. You know, he doesn't have an axe in his head. He's just on the floor dead. And it's really just sad.
Yeah. It's just such an interesting little film, because I guess you don't think it's going to go there, like, especially because it's an Aaron Spelling production. It's interesting, too, because these are both Aaron Spelling productions. I think that he just has a thing about boats. I'm not sure what they are. When you watch Love Boat, Love Boat does have serious things happen on the show, but you never expect it to really, like, it doesn't look at the same dynamics the way this movie did. You know, like it's digging into dysfunction and, like, unhappy marriages. In Love Boat, it's all about correcting those, right? And so it's doing the opposite. But it's really interesting that it came from there. But like I said, like, just some of the dialogue, and what you said about Edward Albert's death also is really poignant, because I hadn't thought of that, but you're right, because she just comes back and he's in the hall, and it is a moment where you're like, oh my God. And but like just them talking about, like, my wife's in the refrigerator and him falling from the ship. It's just such an interesting, weird movie. And it's funny because it starts off just like an episode of Love Boat, where they're throwing the streamers out and waving.
Yeah, who are we waving at? I don't know. You just wave, you know. And Jerry Carter there gets some really bad exposition, like, well, I'm an insurance salesman, honey. I don't have That's a heart right. or whatever. You know, it's just like he gets the bad exposition. The young couple get to wave, and it does feel like a Love Boat that's about to go to hell. Love Boat goes to hell.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. And also, just another shout out to Cesare De Nova, not just because I like saying his name, but also like the crew, the little we know of the crew, with the exception of the guy that gets hit over the head when he's trying to protect them. These guys are smart, you know?
Yes.
And so what's so interesting about TV movies, you see a lot more in TV movies than you do in theatricals, and actually you see a lot in disaster TV movies, is that the, I'm just going to call them the patriarchy, but the people who are like running the show, like the corporate heads and people who run the ship and the captains and whatever, you're expecting them to halt progress. Because in a lot of movies, there's always that guy that, like, runs the corporation. He's like, oh, well, we have a holiday coming. They don't really do that as much in TV movies. They actually participate and they want to help. And so, like, there are better examples of this. But whereas, like, you might expect the captain to be like, oh, well, we can't let people know there's people dying on the ship, and let's just brush this under the carpet and keep an eye on them. He's fully into it. Like, let's figure out what's going on, and let's catch this guy, and let's take care of it. And so, like, everybody's trying to figure out what's happening, and I really love that. It's a lot of fun, and I think it makes the characters more likable. And I like that the crew is smart, with the exception of the guy that gets hit over the head while he's trying to protect people. That guy's not very smart.
doesn't the captain have a point where he says, like, he has the point where he says, we're locking everything down. Everyone stays in their cabins until we find out what's going on. It's like, wow, on a pleasure cruise to do that when it's clearly, when it clearly seems to be a group of people are being sought after rather than everybody. But, yeah, no, I do like that, yeah.
Yeah, it does things differently than theatricals do, and that's another reason why I like this movie so much. Yeah, it was really good. I don't know if there's a ton more to say about it. No. Do you guys want to say anything else? Well, I know I feel like Nate might have more to say since this is his slasher cruise.
Well, what I wanted to say is, why is the doctor not joining the FBI? Because I wouldn't have figured out any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I was lost when he was explaining it, and I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. So does that, I guess. All right.
Well, don't you know there was a spinoff called Dr. FBI?
Oh, that would be perfect.
Yeah, it was just two episodes, but it was really good. Yeah.
Oh, and I missed it.
I know. I'm sorry.
part of me likes to think that maybe the writer was, and I'm just making this up, maybe the writer was asked to write it and was told, you're going to write about these three couples, a la, and I know Love Boat wasn't on yet, but a la the futuristic show Love Boat, futuristic as in 4 years in the future or 5 years in the future. And you're going to write, and he came in and he wrote the script, and in the end he was able to, you know, wrap up all their stories with emotional arcs and proper endings. And then Aaron Spelling came in, ripped the, like, last 30 or 40 pages out and went, okay, start to kill them right here. And is a what? I gave them all the arcs and emotional the stories and everything. No. We start to kill them. I because I always find that I would think from writing as I have, when you know that you're going to kill off all these characters, it can become tough to write the stories for the characters because you're writing them to the point where they die. So I like maybe that in this one. You know, he wrote the full stories, and they said, okay, stop this person's life here, stop this person's life here, and here, et cetera.
That would be interesting because, you know, I saw it as the opposite. What I saw was that they got a script, or Aaron Spelling concocted it, and they wrote it, and he started to think, oh, we can have, like, multiple stories on a ship.
Yeah.
And maybe we can look into that. I don't know when the Love Boats book came out, to be honest. I have it, and I've tried to read it. It's horrible. So I don't know how he got inspired for boats, but it's got all of the qualities that Love Boat has. And one of the things it has, and we talked about, was that it's generational. So we've got the older couple, the middle-aged couple, and the young couple. That's signature Love Boat.
Yeah.
You know? And like the setup, all of it is Love Boat up until the murders, you know? So I just kind of wonder if like they wrote a script and then he was like, ding, you know what?
Yes.
What if we did it and they lived and they found each other, they found their way back to each other? What would that look like?
And there was a laugh track.
Yeah, there was a laugh track and we had a kooky crew. And it's interesting because Captain Stooping starts off as an idiot. He's no Cesare De Nova. I'll tell you that much, you know, because Captain Stooping evolves a lot through Love Boat. He starts off as a buffoon and he ends up as this pretty dignified guy at the end. So he's not like that. But yeah, it's kind of like I feel like somewhere the roots were planted for Love Boat in Death Cruise.
And doesn't Captain Stooping end up with Marion Ross in the end?
He does. That? Yeah, Tom Bosley. He had to kill Tom Bosley off to get her.
Of course. Yeah. Maybe it was Captain Stubik. Yeah, now it all makes
sense. Yeah, that was a twist that Michael Constantine did not think about.
I have just one more thing. There's a scene in here where right before Sylvia dies, where a steward or someone brings her a drink, an Atlanta blackout. And it's obviously it's the killer has sent her this drink to remind her of Atlanta and whatever was supposed to have happened, and she looks very disturbed by it. But the scene is shot just like like the steward or whoever is standing behind the sun or a big light. And so the light is shining
on
me.
I keep
like looking at his face going, is that Richard Long? No, that isn't Richard Long. But they're, and they shoot it in such a weird way. It almost feels, I was going to say, I mentioned this earlier, it almost feels like how the Redeemer would show up throughout the Redeemer in kind of weird ways and strange ways. It just has this thing like, here's your drink, madam. And it's like, what is this? It's an Atlanta blackout. Bum, bum, bum. No, the music doesn't do that. But you know, light is behind him. It's really weird.
I just want to say, I'm glad you brought up the Redeemer again, because I think we'll wrap up the conversation with this. But what I think we've pointed out is we've all referenced like a gazillion horror movies just now that we love that Death Cruise reminds us of. And so if you're listening and you're super into slashers or giallos, it turns out, you might want to check this out. It's not as scary as a lot of those movies, but it's got all those elements, and it's kind of a really great film for people who love slashers, I think.
Agreed. Definitely.
So we're going to recommend it, I think. Nate, you going to recommend it?
I do recommend it.
Ooh, look at that. Finally, I picked one we could all agree on. I can't believe I did that. So let me just go through the background real quick, and then we'll get to the next movie. And I can't believe we did that without things just completely blowing up and stuff. So I'm really happy about that stuff. Okay, so it aired on ABC on October 30th, 1974. So it was a Halloween movie, guys, which makes it even better. I made a note here what other Halloween movies aired in 1974. So I just want to briefly tell you that Halloween season of 1974 was actually a really, really plum TV movie horror thing. But all the movies were different. And I'll just tell you what else aired for that season. There was The Stranger Within, which is a classic with Barbara Eden, of course, based off the Richard Matheson story. That's a really good one. There was something called Locust, which I don't know if either one of you have seen, but it's sort of an animal amok slash drama with Ron Howard and Ben Johnson and Katherine Helmond. And it's absolutely amazing. It's actually more drama than it is horror, but the Locust scenes are really harrowing. I mean, they're amazing. Then there was Where Have All the People Gone with Peter Graves, which was kind of this post-apocalyptic. It feels like a pilot, but I don't know that it was. About a bunch of people, well, it's about a guy and his two kids, and they're in a cave when this, like, solar flare goes off. And when they come out, everybody's been, like, disintegrated. I don't know if either one of you have seen it, but it's really, really good. It's on Amazon Prime currently. If anybody wants to see it, it's really creepy. And then, of course, our favorite, Bad Ronald, also aired in October of 1974 for Halloween. And I don't even have to tell you what that's about, because we all know. And we covered it, if anybody wants to go back and listen to that. So the original title of this movie was just The Cruise, which I really like. It was filmed in August of 1974 with an 11-day shooting schedule. So I only bring that up because August, September, October, right? So 2 months they had to shoot it and do post-production and get it on the air. And they did a really good job with it. A lot of TV movies get this kind of turnaround. It ran against on CBS something called Sons and Daughters and an episode of Canon. On NBC, it ran against Little House on the Prairie and Lucas Tanner. It was actually kind of promoted heavily because it ran the same week as the airing of The Poseidon Adventure, which ran as the ABC Sunday night movie and was ended up being the top-rated program of the week, The Poseidon Adventure. It got a 39.5/62, which means 62% of America was watching The Poseidon Adventure on the night it aired. It ended up being the third highest rated film to air on TV at that time. The number one movie was Airport. Number two was Love Story. Death Cruise did really well, though, following off of that. It won the night in the ratings and was in the top 20 for the week. There was some confusion about the ratings, though, because some newspapers listed Rhoda as the number one, and I don't remember what the other newspaper said the number one was, but I think that's because some of the ratings went up to Sunday and some started on Monday. I think that Rhoda might have aired on a Sunday. I'm not positive of that. I don't know. It was confusing. But anyway, it did really well, even though it only came in at number 103 for the season. It got a 16.3/31, which just means 31% of the television viewing audience was watching Death Cruise, as you do. It was filmed on the Queen Mary in Long Beach. I found this news article where they interviewed Tom Bosley and Celeste Holm. It says here, Tom Bosley, Polly Bergen, and Celeste Holm were filming a scene from ABC's TV's Death Cruise when director Ralph Sineski asked for two women to snuggle up closer to Bosley. I feel like a book, chuckled Bosley. The joy of sex, no doubt, replied Celeste. See how much fun they were having, guys?
Gosh, wow.
Yeah.
Missed to see.
Yeah, he got it not just from Marion, he was getting it from everybody. The wine on the ship was cranberry juice. I don't know if you guys knew this, but this would be Richard Long's last performance. He actually died a little after
Oh,
they
yes.
shot this. He was only 47. He that year, I think he made another TV movie, which is really good, called The Girl King Gift Wrapped with Karen Valentine, that I really enjoy. We talked a bit about Polly Bergen in our Haunting of Sarah Hardy episode. If people want to go back and listen to that, I'll leave the trivia for that. But she placed a wildly different character in that, too. She was a really wonderful actress. Kate Jackson, of course, would go on to become the queen of the TV movie. At this point, she was most famous for The Rookies, and she had also appeared in Saint School for Girls and Killer Bees. Ralph Sineski, who is the director, he's still alive. He's in his 90s. He has a really amazing website, which I'll try to post a link to when I post this episode. He said that he couldn't film the water. So anyway, if you go on his website, he writes about everything he ever did. And he only made a couple TV movies, but he goes in depth on the making of Death Cruise. So I'm only going to cover a very little bit of it. If you're interested in how they shot the movie and anything else, go to this site because it's amazing. He said he couldn't film the waters after the ship left the harbor because the deep sea looked much different. So they were right on shore when they filmed it, and it just didn't look as natural. So he had to keep everything sort of on the ship proper. Sineski really enjoyed the final product, but he said it felt like an elongated episode of a TV show, which we kind of said because we said it felt like a Love Boat. Sineski also said that parts of the last scene were shot later to make the ending more clear. I don't remember him being more clearer than that about what was shot, but I guess there was some confusion about the ending in the original script, maybe. So the screenwriter's name is Jack P. Sowards. He was a episodic guy. He did some theatricals. It turns out he also wrote Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
What?
Death Cruise. A Star wow. Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Yeah.
Super, super fun different. Movie. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This guy knows what he's doing. And as we all know, Ricardo Montalban would play Mr. Rourke. So there, it's all attached to Aaron Spelling, no matter how you cut it, guys. And that's all the trivia I have about Death Cruise. So what can I say? We all really enjoyed it. It's not too hard to find, so everybody should seek it out and give it a go. It's a lot of fun. As much as I loved Death Cruise, no spoilers, but I'm going to tell you, I love Cruising to Terror 10 times more. It's so amazing. So let's just, yes, I know it's hard to believe, but it's true. So let's go ahead and just dive into Cruising to Terror.
There is a devil. There is no doubt. But is he trying to get in us or trying to get out?
All right. Now, this is even more ensemble casting than the last one. I'm going to try not to get lost, and I'm going to try to keep it as quick as possible. But we have a ship. The ship is I'm looking at Meryl right now. Hugh O'Brien plays Andy, in parentheses, Captain. So I guess Hugh O'Brien plays Captain Andy. And on the ship, he has a guy named Emmanuel, he has a guy named Nathan, and he has a guy named Simon. Simon is played by Mr. Dirk Benedict. And they have a ship, I think it's called the Opia? And
oh, no, it's the Obeya. It's the Obeya. That's a voodoo term.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like Cassiopeia or something. Obeya. Okay. All right. I
think so.
So they got a ship, but it's not a passenger ship, but there's a they're in the vicinity of Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico and such, and they have to take on board 8 passengers and sort of get them to a location because the cruise ship is overbooked. So this is kind of a cruise on kind of a tinier ship, and it's at the beginning it's very much like, well, the ship's only got one engine, why are you doing this to me, and da 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 and whatever. But he brings on board the 8 passengers. I'll just say them really quickly, and I'm going to get some of them. I'm going to do my best. Of course, you get the Berries, Sandra and Neil. Hooray! Linda Day George and Christopher George. Christopher George's character is very greedy, sort of, and seems to be ignoring his wife a lot, which is very strange to me. And she just wants to try to rekindle their romance, which probably means that she didn't think they'd end up on this dingy old one-engine boat crammed into a little space. But she can work with it. She's Linda Day George. And you also get Reverend Mather, played by John Forsythe, and Lil Mather, played by Lee Merriweather. He is a very devout reverend who has apparently had some booze issues, and she is a little wary of him. She doesn't seem as sort of enamored of him as maybe she once was. They seem very shaky. And then you get Ray Milland shows up as Dr. Is it Isaiah Beckham. I forget the pronunciation on his name, but he is an archaeologist kind of guy who has a very interesting theory, which we will hear about in a moment. Then who else is there? There is Judy and Debbie, correct? I'm getting lost in the names here. Judy is Joanne Harris, and Debbie is Hillary Thompson, and they're just two pals who have come on board and are just trying to to have a good time. Is that right?
Debbie, did I get the names right? Debbie is the ugly one.
Yes, I was just about to say, yeah. Judy, played by Joanne Harris, is sort of hot one, and Debbie is the one who wears glasses and is a little sort of mousy and such.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. She's gorgeous, yeah. Though. And they're like, oh, you're the ugly one. You'll never meet a guy because you wear glasses. And it's just like, really, guys? She's like a size 2, and she looks like a model, and there's some glasses on her. And then they're gorgeous, like, oh, she's hideous.
And then we get Frank Converse, of course. Yes, yeah, Frank Converse.
What's his name?
Matt Lazarus.
That's your first clue, yeah.
Oh boy, something's going on there. And so there's that and that. And did I get them? Oh, Stella Stevens is Marilyn Magnuson. She is on there also. Yes. She's traveling by herself and flirts with Andy, Captain Andy, a lot. And so they leave and they go on their way and they're traveling and they get to know one another. They're doing some diving here and there. They're hanging out. They're having meals. It's all great. And then we learn from Dr. Beckham. He has a theory about the ancient Egyptians and Mexico, which is why he's here and which you're going to hear now.
You are a physicist, sir?
Well, sort of. I'm really into mathematics, Professor Bakun.
Well, you know me.
My reputation, of course, and your books on the Mayan-Egyptian cross-culturization.
That's it. That's where I know you from. Dr. Isaiah Bakun, anthropologist, archaeologist, biblical scholar. This is an honor, sir.
I'm afraid you're one of the few who think so.
Well, surely, Professor, you don't mean that.
You think not? I've spent my entire life gathering proof that the ancient Egyptians sailed to Mexico 2,000 years ago and founded the Mayan civilization. But not one of my neo-Neanderthal colleagues will accept that theory.
You must admit, Professor, that your theory runs contrary to popular belief.
Nonsense. Some years ago in Egypt, I found a piece of ancient papyrus which revealed that Cleopatra Selenus ordered a tomb built where the sun hits the sea. Now, my calculations prove that that tomb is on the island of Cozumel in Mexico, and I shall prove everything when I find that tomb.
And it's super ludicrous. He's like, oh, the Egyptians got on a boat, and then they dropped off this thing in the water. And then the Mayans showed up, and they're the Mayans. The Mayans are Egyptians. Like, whatever.
What were they thinking when they wrote that script?
I don't know. It was just like, I mean, it was good storytelling, right? So, like, the thing is, they tell stories throughout this. Like, everybody gets a chance to tell a story about something. And they're good. The actors are convicted, you know? Is that the word I want to use? Mm-hmm. Convicted to the role?
Committed. Committed. Yes, committed.
You know what I mean? They've been convicted, and now they're serving by making this movie. So the storytelling is good, and I'll be willing to buy it because Ray Milland says it, you know, and whatever he says, I'm going to buy. But yeah, it's like really, Egyptians? How did they even get to Mexico? Like, I don't even understand. Whatever.
I do have something about that when we actually discuss the movie regarding that theory. Because the first time I watched this, like 4 years ago, I was like, huh? But I've actually been working on something the past few months where I still might go, huh? Yeah, so yes, exactly. My own Contiki. I've been traveling on a little raft across the ocean. So what ends up happening is, the ship, there's trouble with the ship, and they end up wandering into the because Frank Converse's character, Matt Lazarus, I believe he's a mathematician or he's something, and he's figured out where Dr. Beckham, where this site was supposed to be. It's underwater now. And they kind of end up near there. So they all go for a little check, you know, go to check it out. And they end up pulling after losing Nathan, I believe, one of the crew members, and possibly more crew members.
Only,
I got,
the only black man in the movie, and he has this horrible accent, and it's Roger Mosley, by the way, from Magnum PI, and who's wonderful, and and he, of course he dies, and then this Mexican deckhand shows up who I didn't remember seeing him before, like he's just all of a sudden they're like Julio or whatever his name is, Emmanuel. They're like clean up the deck, and he's like yes sir, and I'm like where did that guy show up?
Because all you're thinking is Dirk Benedict and Hugh O'Brien. And that's like, okay, well I guess...
That's all you need, really.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so like, oh my God, that ship, that's why nobody's complaining about being on that ship, guys, because...
Yeah, that's exactly when Judy and Debbie see that Dirk Benedict is on there, they're like, aren't you from Battlestar Galactica? And he says, in about 6 months, ladies. Give me 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Just hold on.
Yeah, I'm working for Spelling now, I'll be working for Larson.
He says to Judy, yeah, give me 6 months. But then he says to Debbie, oh, never, never.
Never.
You are so hideous, Debbie.
Not with the glasses.
No.
So they end up pulling up this tiny, like baby-sized sarcophagus, and it's gold, and it's pretty incredible. Ish, and you know, Dr. Beckham is crazy about it, and everyone's like, oh my God, this thing, and the captain's like, you know what, Dirk Benedict is fixing the ship, once he gets it fixed, we're going to head back to wherever they were going, somewhere in Mexico, but there's actually a scene where the passengers kind of speak to Captain Andy about wanting to go back to the U.S.
After the engine's repaired, do you intend to continue on to Cozumel?
That's right, what?
We were talking about it before you came in. And we agree it'd be better if we returned to the States. We see that sarcophagus and the artifacts we brought up, they're quite valuable. I mean, not only financially, but historically. And the Mexicans, well, they have some very strict national treasure laws.
I understand, but that's not my priority. Especially the condition this ship is in. We're not going to take unnecessary risks. We're closer to Cozumel, and that's where we're headed.
Now hold it, Captain. Those artifacts are ours. And we're going to keep them. We voted on it.
I love this scene because of the way it ends, because Christopher's like, we voted on it. Like, like there's so much conviction. Now I've got the word right. Yeah. There's so much conviction in his voice, yes. That he's like, oh, nah, 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 we all voted, Captain. But the captain runs the ship.
He's the captain. Yeah, he's the law on the ship.
Yeah.
So it's like, and then what happens at this point? You know, I've got Debbie up on the screen here. She looks a bit like Margot Kidder in Superman. She looks a bit Lois Lane.
If she was hideous.
Yeah, if Margot Kidder was hideous. So what happens at this point is you get this little sarcophagus, and the Reverend Mather says, throw it off the ship, get rid of it. It's basically, you know, 2,000 years ago, you know, we had, like, every 1,000 years something terrible-ish happens, and he believes the son of Satan is in that sarcophagus. And everyone's like, oh, blow it out your hole, Reverend. But he's like, come on. And what begins to happen is sort of in the way that after the first death and death cruise, things begin to deteriorate. That kind of happens here, and some ways in more disturbing ways than others. There's actually a scene right here where Judy and Debbie, who have been real sweet to each other the whole time, but you get kind of the feeling that I believe Debbie paid for Judy to be on the cruise, but Judy's having more fun.
Yes, because she's ugly and she needs a friend.
Yeah. There's something to do with the flare gun, and I'm going to let you guys listen to this. Judy and Debbie beginning to have a rough time.
Now that's all you have to do.
I don't think I can do it, Judy.
Debbie, you have to do it. Now, if there are ships in the neighborhood, this could be our only chance of getting out of here alive. You don't have a choice.
Okay. But stay with me, please. I can't stay out here alone. I'm scared, Judy.
I don't care if you're scared. You're always scared. Well, I am sick of it, and I'm sick of you.
Judy, don't say that.
Please! Why? Can't you stand the truth?
What are you talking about?
I am talking about always following me around, bribing me with trips and cruises. Well, I don't rub off! So why don't you just accept who and what you are?
What am I?
I don't know and I don't care, but you're not me! And I am sick to death of trying to help you become something you're not! Now leave me alone!
Yeah, it's just silly. Like, I don't understand how they elected Debbie as the flare gun person. And then,
Yeah.
but it makes, I kind of understand where she's coming from. She does not want to be left alone, but
Yeah.
Judy is so intent on leaving her there, probably to spend time with Dirk Benedict. But this is where everybody starts to kind of like, whatever,
It
like your insecurity was
all
or your
falls apart.
flaw, yeah,
Yeah.
it just gets bigger and worse and it eats you alive, and then you become that flaw or that insecurity. And
And
so, like, they've all been taken over, right, by like something bigger than them that's digging at their sores and making them boils, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And so,
yes.
Judy and Debbie fall to this, but it's bonkers. Like, for 20 minutes, like, everybody's going insane. And, like, Christopher George is horrible to his wife. Like, he
Oh,
throws her on the
berated.
bed, and, like, don't do that. Don't do
Yeah,
that.
no. Yeah, and so I'll sort of
Oh, and
in my
Lil.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess
Yeah.
that's the twist. We'll wait on that. That's the twist, okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just end my sort of plot synopsis with it. Yeah, the Reverend says, I forget if it does he say that I forget I didn't write down the numbering, but he says something like 12 people are assembled and one of them will be the
Yes.
guardian of the evil thing or something. Oh no, he says, I think it's like 13 will be, or I forget, but he says we'll be assembled and it will be the right number, like a gestalt of the right number of people to bring this thing back to life, and one of us will be the guardian. And if one of us is the guardian, then we're basically not human. Now there is a black cat running around, but I'll leave that till later, or maybe we'll forget that. I don't know. But I'm just going to leave it there. The son of Satan might be in a sarcophagus. The sarcophagus might be breathable.
Yes.
The shit's going to hit the fan. So I'll stop it right there.
Yeah, I love that the sarcophagus breathes. Like, that's such a neat effect in this movie. It's kind of unexpected and it's cool, because it's not that grand. Like, what did you say? It was like a really impressive-ish sarcophagus, because it's tiny. It's like a foot long, and it's got a little tiny head with like the big helmet thing around it. It's not that great. But I guess it's solid gold, right? So it's worth something to somebody. But also, you forgot to mention that they go for a swim and there's a shark.
Oh, the shark scene. Yep.
Because
Oh,
it's a
yeah.
skinny shark,
Larry
too.
pants.
Yes, it's a little skinny shark. He's a cutie. And he's like gunning for them.
I was hoping actually like a
Oh!
zombie or something would pop up.
Well, the best part, though, is that Hugh O'Brien jumps in the water and he pulls out a knife, and then the shark runs away. So I didn't know that the shark, he understood what the knife was and he took off. Like, he
Well,
responds.
that's Wyatt Earp, isn't it? Didn't he play Wyatt Earp, I
Yes.
believe? So yes. And he was in Search, so yeah, I'd run away too if Hugh O'Brien came after me.
Well, I just love that he understood that a knife was like a. Like, oh, this shit's
Whoa,
getting real,
no,
guys. It's getting real.
yeah,
That's why that shark is so skinny, because he understands,
yes,
right, when there's danger.
I've run away from more meals than I should have, but I keep
Yeah,
trim.
that's basically what happened. I do love that scene. Anything with the shark, it automatically shoots it up to like the top of my list, because I love sharks so much. But now, I've seen this one before as well. I guess we'll just do the twist here, since I did it so early on in the last time. So basically, all this shit hits the fan, but the big reveal happens when Lil, Lee Meriwether's character, who's married to the Reverend, is basically like, we find out that she's been pent up sexually for like a long time, and that the evil one understands this. And so she's kind of, I guess she's walking around or whatever. And it's interesting, because she plays this really plain woman, but when she takes her hair down, ooh, it's Lee Meriwether, guys. She's beautiful. And so she's walking around the ship, and Matt Lazarus, if that didn't give it away, shows up, and he's like, basically, I know what you need, and come to me. And he's Frank Converse, so he didn't have to be Satan, first of all. He just had to come to the door like he is and ask me over, and that's all he had to do. But anyway, for her, he has to be Satan. And so he uses his spell working or whatever, the guardian of Satan or whatever he is, and they have sex, and then she sort of belongs to him afterwards. And so he's kind of like slowly recruiting the passengers to his side by causing all this chaos and stuff. And then the Reverend, he has like a showdown of sorts, right?
Sort
Because
of.
isn't the
Yes. There's fire.
Maybe you should take over. Yeah, because I'm getting hazy on exactly what happens. So they all end up, so just a few of them end up in this room, right? So Ray Milland goes in there to like open it or something, and he gets attacked by the sarcophagus, like it rolls over on him and it kills him. And then I think randomly people end up in the room, the people that are like the recruits. So Debbie's in there. So Debbie gets taken over. I don't know if Christopher George ends up in there or not, but I know that Lil's in there with Matt, and the Reverend's in there, and he's doing his hoopy-joopy stuff, his exorcism or whatever, and the cat's in there. And this fire erupts. Basically, all the bad people go down with the ship. Debbie lives. And I can't remember. Christopher George must survive, but does he?
I believe he does. I want to say he does. I would have written down he died. I would have.
Yeah, I feel like the spell is broken enough, except for, like, obviously if you sleep with him, that's a more intense, something more intense that's happened there. Yeah. But anyway, so they all kind of, like, snap back, and they end up on a little dinghy or whatever, and they just go home. But, like, we also forgot to mention that Stella Stevens and Captain Andrews have this really amazing night together.
Yes.
Everything's falling apart. She's trying so hard to get laid on the ship, and you're like, dude, it's Stella Stevens.
Why doesn't this happen immediately?
Why is this so difficult? And so finally, her and Captain Andrews end up together, and they talk about all these things that are happening, and she has this great poem, which I played in between the segments here, that's really mm-hmm. good, and she's like kind of an anchor. Like, she's untouchable, as far as I know, from the Guardian, because I don't think he even tried to reach her in any kind of way, or Captain Andrews. By the way, that's Andy Andrews. Let's keep that clear.
Is that Andy?
I believe so, yes. So you can't his life's already ruined. You can't corrupt him any further. When you grow up as Andy Andrews, that's it.
Yeah.
and I think the sarcophagus just ends up back down at the bottom of the ocean.
Yes.
Like Jason did at the lake in Friday 13th, Part 6. And that's it. That's your cruising chair, and I feel really bad that I can't remember how Christopher George ended up, but you know, we had to postpone this by like a week, and I didn't get a chance to rewatch it. So,
well, and let's just be honest, this movie throws everything but the kitchen sink at you.
Yes,
it's very clear. Yeah. It's very clear what's happening, Nate. If you can't follow it, I can't. Yeah,
it lost me. I loved it though for that reason. That's why I enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, so go ahead, tell us what you thought of it.
Oh, I mean, it was just a fun movie. I thought it was completely nonsensical, and just the whole basic plot line just is hilarious to me. I mean, at first, when I first was hearing, you know, when they were talking about the sarcophagus being, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico, and I was just thinking, is this satire? Or, I mean, this seems pretty serious, so I'm thinking we're supposed to take this seriously. But that was kind of part of what made it fun. I mean, that shark attack scene, huh? That's one for the books right there. It was great, though.
He pulls out a knife.
Yeah.
Like, and the shark, like, recognizes that that's a weapon.
The shark's like, yeah, I don't want none of that.
Beats don't fail me now.
Got like some these fans today. I am not about to get them messed up.
I love it. I love it. Yeah.
But yeah, that was good. And I just love how dramatic everything is, you know, like, there's just so many scenes that are just, like, very, you know, like, the music's like, dun-dun! So, I mean, that stuff's just amazing. It's funny, because right now on my screen is that scene with the flare gun where they're arguing, or actually, they're not really arguing. I mean, poor Debbie's just like, why are you saying all these things to me? She's getting, like, ripped apart.
Oh, Judy's not cool.
No, but I think that, you know, it was the stress of the situation and maybe the sarcophagus as well.
I think it was the sarcophagus. I feel like he was getting inside everybody and making them do horrible things to each other. Yeah, because she flipped out for like no real reason.
Yeah.
And Debbie had a legit, please don't leave me up here, because
I really wouldn't want to be left alone either. I mean, she has pretty good reason why. You know what? Her friend, really, Judy, she needs to take Debbie after all this is done now. She really needs to take her and be like, you know what? I'm going to give you a makeover. And then she just takes her glasses off and is like, shake your hair. There you go.
Debbie had an adorable haircut. Like, there was nothing wrong with Debbie.
No, there wasn't. That's what was so funny to me.
Yeah.
I was just like, really? The ugly one, guys. She's the ugly. Don't let me on that boat, because my self-esteem couldn't handle it.
It reminds me of, I don't know if either of you have seen that movie from the 90s called The Granny, but they have...
Oh, yes.
The daughter in the movie is played by an actress called Shannon Worry, who is obviously, like, a beautiful. Gorgeous. She is gorgeous. And all they've done is give her, like, an unflattering hairstyle and a pair of glasses, and everybody in the movie talks about how ugly she is and how she'll never find anybody, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Look at her. That's kind of what I was thinking with Debbie. I'm like, come on. Yeah. She's obviously an attractive person.
Yeah.
It's so funny you're trying to make it seem like, oh, she's just so homely. She has to buy friends.
Yeah, that's... That's poor Debbie. Poor
Debbie. But... I felt for her. I did too. At least she lived.
Yeah, it was kind of nice, like, when the spell was broken that Judy was like, come on! Come on! Because, like, it wouldn't have felt right. I feel like the people who died at the end were the people who should have died at the end. You know? Like, it was great that some people got to, like, jump out of that state they were in and, like, resume their life, you know, and go back to being nice people. Because what happened between Debbie and Judy was really minor, you know? And it's forgivable. And so, like, and I like that she came through at the end for her buddy. Although, if Dirk Benedict was there, she might have just thrown her over.
Is that what you would have done?
Yes. It's Dirk Benedict, guys. Or Hugh O'Brien.
You would have heard Debbie go, as she was flying overboard, I'm ugly after all! Psh, she hit the water.
I tell you, the poor ending Debbie. I wanted to see for this one is I wanted Elizabeth Mason to pop up and be like, hey, I dropped the sarcophagus ear.
Throwing her card across.
The image of the card is my favorite part. Like, just throwing it down.
Yeah. Like, I think that it'd be funny if somebody had, like, if there was, like, a scene of her doing that, I would add it to the end of so many movies.
Oh.
Like, and here's my card.
It's Aaron Spelling, so it could be, like, the Aaron Spelling verse. Like, these characters who show up from TV movie to TV movie.
Celeste Holm is always the twist ending.
She's always the twist ending.
What could have been is right.
Oh, Aaron, I thought up the ending. No, I already know the ending. Get Holm on the phone. All right. Phone home.
That's right.
Phone home.
So, Dan, what did you think of this one?
As with Nate, I think the joy of the movie is that it really does throw – it's like 96, 97, 98 minutes of just throwing everything it can at you. Now, I will say the one – not a problem I had with it, because I could watch this movie endlessly – but I just think I think it would have worked better in the 90-minute time slot. I think it would have worked better if they had because they don't actually retrieve the sarcophagus till like 45 minutes into the movie or something like that. So it's like and it's fun to have them all hanging out. It's the sarcophagus kind of drives the second half forward, and there's sort of no. Like, as much as I love the second half with the sarcophagus and everything, and trying to figure out, like, okay, the sarcophagus is breathing and it's creepy, but how much is it doing and how much is it everyone being changed because of having this thing here and not actually affecting them? Maybe it's just – it's the devil inside of them coming out.
I love it.
Because that was part of it to me is if you hadn't seen the sarcophagus breathing, there really isn't much that shows it as being, like – an evil, terrible thing. Like, nothing leaps, or does it? No, you know, it's not that there isn't a huge monster doesn't leap out of it and grab everyone and eat them.
No.
So to me, it was like if you hadn't seen it breathing, it was almost like could this be a mix of the sarcophagus's influence and the actual like the evil inside of these people doing stuff, which I really liked. However. In the second half of the movie, there's so much – well, there's a lot in the first half, but once the sarcophagus is discovered, there's so much going on that there was a point where – and my notes actually show this. There's a point where I stopped taking notes. There's a point where my brain just went pshoop and just shut down, and I was just watching things happen. Now, that's not bad. I've seen The Last Slumber Party 40 times, you know, so I can get my brain.
Ooh, you slipped in another one, Dan.
Yeah, do you like that? I thought I hadn't done those in ages. I hadn't done those in ages. But, you know, there are films like that, you know, where like, you know, Night to Dismember, something like that. You know, it's just like these goofy, crazy films where all this stuff happens. And after a while, your mind just sort of stops and you're just watching things happen. That's not bad.
Well, that's a really good thing. So let me tell you, until recently, I have been riddled with really, really bad insomnia. I've been sleeping really good the last few nights, but like I literally would go like 2 or 3 days on like 4 or 5 hours sleep, and it was driving me bonkers. The thing about movies like Cruise into Terror, what you say, is that your brain shuts off. It puts me to sleep in a good way. So this is an action-packed yes. movie, and I feel like anybody watching it, you're not going to fall asleep. But there's a point where you're just letting them just do – you're like, forget it. I don't know what's going on anymore. Just let them do what they got to do, you know? And it's relaxing because you're just kind of letting them play things out. And it made me – I had to turn it off. So I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to finish this film tonight because I'm actually relaxed for the first time in like – 2 months.
That's awesome.
And so I'll watch it in the morning when I wake up over with my coffee, which is what I did. But it's like it's wonderful that way because sometimes movies are there to just entertain you. And it doesn't matter to me how they do it as long as they're entertaining. And this did it in such a way that it actually took all of the anxiety that I've been carrying around for 2 months and it kind of pushed it to the side and it just took over. And it was like, oh, I think I can go to bed and fall asleep. And so it was really good. So I know what you're saying. Like, it's like a cozy mystery. You know, you let them do the driving. It's like, so when you watch Murder, She Wrote, you can play along. And I did at first, but it's really just about watching the guest stars come on and be the guest stars and be awesome and have Jessica Fletcher do what Jessica Fletcher does. And so there's a point where you just stop. You're like, oh, somebody died. Okay, whatever. And you just let them do what they need to do to get to the end of the episode. And it feels good. Father Dowling, so good. That's exactly what Father Dowling does. And so Cruise into Terror does that, but it does it on acid.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes, it,
so,
yeah.
You know, it just goes crazy. So your mind can't even function if it wanted to. But that's a good thing. I think it worked really well. But anyway, Dan, I didn't mean to cut you off, but...
One of the things I've always said, like there's a movie I love, and I forget what you guys think of this one, but it's Byron Quisenberry's Scream from 81, 82, the one set in the Texas ghost town with, like,
you forgot
Albie
what
Moore
Nate
and Woody
thinks of that movie?
I think Nate likes
mean,
that
that's
movie,
that's the
too.
Movie that the dude blocked me over because I said I liked it.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, I think I got into a semi-fight with a guy on Twitter over that who was just like, when I would say, like, I actually think it's quite good, and I would give them the link to the thing I wrote on Bleeding Skull. And he'd be like, oh, that's okay, dude, but it sucks, LOL. And I thought, well, that's not really an argument. And then I stopped talking to him. Yeah, Scream is one that I put on, and Curse of the Headless Horseman, the Leonard Curtman film, is kind of like this too. I can put on, and at some point, it's so kind of just washes over me that if I fall asleep, it's okay. That's part of the experience. That's if I get so relaxed that I don't know what's happening. It's part of the experience. It's a genre of movie that I don't think we've pinned down yet. And even though Cruising to Terror is crazy, I think it does that. It gets to a point where there are so many familiar faces, so many people you just love to watch, being kind of silly, but giving it their all. They've got that conviction that we love. What do we commission? They got their commission, or whatever it was they got. They're in it, and they're in it to win it. And you just as I watched it the first time, and I watched it the first time like 3 or 4 years ago. This was one of the first films that I think I watched after we started doing this podcast. This was one I was like, I got to watch this, and I watched it. But when I watched it about a week and a half ago, I got 20 minutes to the end, and I just let my mind go. I saw a fire, and I saw people leaving in a boat, and I thought, okay, it's over. And then I thought, well, you're going to have to talk about this, Dan, so you're going to need to know some of the details. I think the only thing I have with it, like I said, is that it doesn't like drive towards, it doesn't like push towards the ending. It just, a lot of stuff happens and then eventually it ends. So it isn't like, imagine it's like jumping off a building with a parachute is Cruising to Terror. Jumping off a building without a parachute would be, you know, what you kind of want. You know, you want it to go, whoa, barrel towards the ending. But Cruising to Terror is like, you know, we're going to take a while to get to the sarcophagus, and then we're going to take a while after. There's no rush. We're in no hurry. So I recommend it, but in my heart, I think it should have been like a 90-minute time slot instead of 2 hour. But everyone's so much fun that I can't denigrate it. And I just had a couple things. Joanne Harris, I'll watch her in anything. She was she's, of course, in the what pretty much the slasher film Deadly Game. She plays Keegan, the extremely charming final-ish girl in that film, which is more or less a slasher film. It's kind of more of a thriller, but it's slashery. And she also plays in the first episode of BJ and the Bear after the TV movie, she plays BJ's love interest. And a season later, she is in the clip show episode of BJ and the Bear, BJ's Sweethearts. So it's always great to see her. Dr. Backham's theories? May I give you my theory on his theories?
Oh, yeah, please, yes.
So the Egyptians came over, blah, 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 blah. Well, there are actually theories out there, and I'm not 100% sure how much I can say at this moment, because what I was... I do transcription sometimes for TV shows, and I've done transcription for a show that is doing an episode about why there are so many sites in North and South America that have iconography from Asia and Europe and Africa.
And so
they like go to like there's a site in Colombia near Bogota that has like all sorts of statues and things and giant phalluses that it's true they are and but they're all like Hindu related, you know, and they brought a Hindu expert there and said, oh, that's Hindu, you know. And there's a site in upstate New York where there are sort of like druid type things happening, and there are some sites where there are what seem to be Egyptian iconography in South America and Mexico and stuff like that. Now, I can't go too far into it, but when
sure.
I think when Dr. Backham said this, I think it sounded screwball, but there have been archaeologists and anthropologists over the years who have said, oh, no, you know, because there is iconography that is in North America, South America, and in other continents that seem to be the same, but most anthropologists, archaeologists say, no, it just happened. You know, in Egypt they did this, and here we did this. But there are others who say, no, they traveled across the water from here to there. His theory is not one that's accepted, but is one that has some credence, sort of, and might have more in future times.
You're just saying the screenwriter, Michael Braverman, probably just didn't pull this out of his ass. You're saying that he probably found a book about these theories and it existed.
I would bet you this being February of 78, I think we were two or three seasons into In Search Of. I'm fairly certain In Search Of probably had at least one episode about folks coming over from Asia, Europe, Africa to the New World, as it were. The only thing about Dr. Backham that's weird is that if he is truly espousing this theory, which at that time and still now is sort of radical, I put that in quotes, I don't know how radical anthropologists and archaeologists, you know, they're not like punks or something, you know, up on stage cutting themselves up or leaping onto people, you know, but radical. The one tricky thing is that when they actually, he's like, the Egyptians came here and this is one of their sites, and they find what seems to be an Egyptian sarcophagus, and it's like, oh, wow, he seems to be proven correct. But then when the reverend holds up like the slab they found with hieroglyphs on it, he says, but we shouldn't take this, doctor, because look at the hieroglyphs. They say this, that, and this. And the doctor's response is, oh, that's just mumbo jumbo. You're going to believe that? Which seems weird that you have someone who believes a theory that no one else believes about the Egyptians, and yet he doesn't believe that Egyptian hieroglyphs actually mean anything and they're mumbo jumbo. So it's kind of like they have him being one type of archaeologist and another type at the same time. And that's a little weird. But the actual theory is interesting. Not proven, but interesting.
Huh. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. So, okay. I don't have a response to that.
No, please. There's no response
to think about. Okay, so, well, we want to keep Nate here, and we have a few more minutes. Yes. So let's wrap this part up. I think we all like this movie. Again, thumbs up?
Yes.
Yes.
Definitely. Okay, great. Okay, yeah. So... let me just give you, I have very little background on this. Let me just give you to you. I do have one piece that I posted on the social media that I don't know if you guys saw. But let me tell you, it aired on February 3rd, 1978 on ABC. It ran against on CBS, the TV movie Dead Man's Curve. This is really interesting. It just occurred to me. You know who's in that? Richard Hatch. So Apollo and Starbuck went toe-to-toe.
What?
In TV movies.
Oh, my gosh. You're right. Yeah.
It just occurred to me. Yeah. And then on NBC was The Rockford Files and Quincy. This movie came in at number 89 for the season, with a pretty good rating here. It got an 18.7/30, which just means 30% of America was watching it when it aired. Killer on Board from the previous year was actually originally also titled Cruise of Terror, so it was very close to that same title before they changed it. Killer on Board is like about a disease on a ship with Patty Duke. It's pretty good. It's not like this. One newspaper said Cruise of Terror was Love Boat crossed with The Exorcist. Another television critic called it a head scratcher. The LA Times said it was outrageous, but passes muster as an amusing time killer. Kevin Thomas, also of the LA Times, said it was lively and melodramatic, and that he felt the writer, director, and cast seemed to be having a great time with the story, which I think Dan pointed out. Linda DeGeorge and Stella Stevens got a shout out. I'm saying that he gave Linda DeGeorge and Stella Stevens a shout out for giving an edge to what he felt were otherwise sketchy characters. Another critic suggested watching with friends and talking back to it. Another journalist said it was better than most movies in this genre, and it had a good cast. So it got generally decent reviews. I think people tapped into the sort of energetic nature behind it. The Casper Star Tribune in Casper, Wyoming, mistakenly called it Voyage into Terror in their promotional material. One of the taglines to promote the movie was Passion Turns to Evil, Cruise into Terror, which I love. Okay, so there was an article that was floating around several newspapers about Stella Stevens and Andrew Stevens. This was a paragraph from it, and I guess this was a thing that almost happened. The Stevens clan is doing all right as far as work goes these days. Stella Stevens is being touted for a prospective series spinoff from the ABC TV movie Cruise into Terror. It's sort of Love Boat come Fantasy Island. So this was actually almost a TV series.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing, right? And I found that in several newspapers. Just this article went around to all the local papers. I guess it's true. So I'm sad it didn't happen, but it was almost a thing. And I would love to talk to Stella Stevens, although I heard she has dementia now, which is really tragic. But I would love to have talked to her about this, because maybe there's a script or some kind of premise that she could have told us about. So Cruise into Terror had a VHS release, which I have, actually. In an interview to... Hugh O'Brien did a couple of interviews to promote the film. He said that he was very lucky that he was able to choose what projects he wanted to work on. He said money wasn't a factor. It was about who was working on the project and if he enjoyed the script. So it's interesting to think of him making this movie because it wasn't something he had to do. So he just really liked the script, and he probably liked working with the cast. He mostly shunned guesting on episodic work because he said that, quote, you're dead in the marketplace when you're seen that way. Although he did do, I think, around this time, a Charlie's Angels, where he played a Hugh Hefner type, and he ends up courting Kate Jackson to take it back to Death Cruise. Yeah, it's a really good episode. It's from the first season, because I think Farrah Fawcett is the Playboy Bunny in it. He said, Cruise into Terror was like the Orient Express crossed with Jaws, or Love Boat with Fantasy Island. By the way, Hugh O'Brien starred in the Fantasy Island pilot movie as well. Oh, I wrote this down just because I thought it was funny. This has nothing to do with the movie. But he went on to say that Aaron Spelling. He went on to say that Aaron Spelling is a very honest guy when it comes to evaluation. And he told me that he thought the movie turned out well in terms of a two-hour movie and that it would get a hell of a rating, which it did. Then Hugh O'Brien jokingly said that there are five stages in the actor's career. I just wrote this down because I thought it was so cute. One, who's Hugh O'Brien? Two, get me Hugh O'Brien. Three, get me a Hugh O'Brien type. Four, get me a young Hugh O'Brien. Five, who's Hugh O'Brien? I thought that was really good. So he said all that in an interview that I really loved that was floating around 1978, I guess. From a 1998 article in the Washington Times, somebody wrote in and said, please advise where I could locate the following videos, Cruise into Terror with Linda DeGeorge and Alice Sweet Alice with Brooke Shields. This was somebody who lived in Hicksville, New York. So the answer was, it was originally released so this just gives you some background on the movie video release. Originally released on the defunct Prism label, Cruise into Terror virtually has vanished.
Oh, yes.
Though you might try mail order specialist at Video Vault. Then they said Alfred Soule's Primo Chiller Alice Sweet Alice is available in a restored collector's edition from Anchor Bay.
That's the one I have VHS. Yeah,
I have it too.
The director's cut, yeah.
Also, there's a Magnum pedigree here. So, of course, Roger Mosley played TC on Magnum, but Stella Stevens was in the episode Find Me a Rainbow, which starred the girl who is the beautiful blonde in Girls' Night Out. And Frank Converse was in my least favorite Magnum PI episode, The Kona Wins. So there's all your Magnum ties.
Intriguing.
Yeah, it was super intriguing, guys. So the... just a little bit about Aaron Spelling. We'll have to do a better episode where we can sort of properly pay tribute to him. But I made these notes. Many of these actors would go on to work for Aaron in other Spelling production, like Cesare De Nova appeared on Fantasy Island. Hugh O'Brien, as I said, was in the pilot for Fantasy Island. He'd also go on to be in one of my favorite episodes, which is Crescendo and the Three Feathers. Now, in he's in the Three Feathers episode, but the Crescendo episode is the one where Monty Markham is half man, half dog. Tony Tennille is a singer that he's been writing music for while he's living on Fantasy Island, and she goes to the island to meet him, but he's like, I don't want to meet her because I'm a half dog. But then she like kisses him and he becomes Monty Markham. So Hilary Thompson, who's the ugly angel, I mean the ugly Debbie, played a fake angel, played a fake angel on an episode of Charlie's Angels. Yeah, and she's also in one of my favorite Fantasy Islands, which is Total Reunion, which is also, by the way, a slasher. And that's a really good one. Christopher George was on Fantasy Island, Charlie's Angels, etc. Linda Day George was on Love Boat. And, of course, we know Kate Jackson would go on to star on Charlie's Angels. Tom Bosley, of course, appeared on Love Boat, and John Forsythe on Dynasty. So you see Aaron Spelling like to use the same actors over and over again. And that's just my background on that. I'm just going to go. We don't have a lot of feedback. So, but we do have one that's kind of long, so let's go ahead and do it real quick. So on Twitter, our friend Icy Greg said, those titles remind me of the theatrical film Triangle, and that's about as slashery as I get. So he hadn't seen the movies yet. On Facebook, Marlon Dobbs said, Cruising to Terror. Watched it recently for the first time in decades, and although it does seem like pretty much the whole budget was applied towards the impressive cast, the movie is intriguing and has some great tension and suspense, plus Joanne Harris and Hilary Thompson, 70 favorites. Oh, I want to tell you, Hilary Thompson, who's the Ugly Debbie, she is currently married to Alan Ormsby, you know, who did Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. Yeah, they're married. And they're awesome.
That's crazy.
Chad Williams? Yeah, Chad Williamson wrote Cruising to Terror? Well, yes, I'll take that ticket, please. What's there to say? I absolutely love this movie. It's one of my favorite TV movies from the 70s. When I was about 9 years old, I saw this movie on a lazy Sunday afternoon, and it terrified me. Years later, in the early 90s, I was working in a video store, remember those, while going to college. One day, while dusting the horror section, I came across Cruising to Terror on the bottom rack. And I knew when I saw the large plastic VHS cover that I had to watch it again to see if it still had the same magic that it did when I was 9. Released in 1978, this movie is the epitome of the slightly creepy, slightly sinister TV movie that I love. The story is simple. A small cruise ship is chartered to the Gulf of Mexico, where it is plagued by mysterious incidents, resulting in the ship being stalled above an ancient burial site of the son of Satan. The passengers retrieve an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus and bring it aboard the cruise ship, and that's when things turn deadly. What I enjoy about this movie is that it's a product of its time. It was broadcast right after The Love Boat and Fantasy Island premiered, and by doing so, it completely cashed in on their popularity. Cruise ship, check. Creepy, but not too creepy since this is network TV, check. Tropical setting? Check. Women in bikinis? Check. TV stars from the 70s? Check. As far as acting goes, it's what you'd expect from all 70s regulars. There are some standouts, though. I love John Forsythe as the crazed preacher consumed with destroying the son of Satan, and Lee Merriweather plays his forlorn, sexually repressed wife. Lee really chews the scenery in this movie, especially when she lets her hair down with Frank Converse and later when she speaks in tongues. Frank Converse plays the mysterious stowaway that may or may not be the guardian of the son of Satan. And Stella Stevens channels her heart of gold hooker character from the Poseidon Adventure, that's true, in a bad wig while flirting openly with the hunky Captain Hugh O'Brien. Oh, and that cat. Let's not forget the creepy black cat is in every scene when something goes wrong. By the way, the cat makes it at the end, too. We forgot to mention that. I loved the most... Yeah, he ends up... Stella Stevens takes him. So maybe Satan survives. He could be the guardian, right?
Yes.
So what I think I love the most about this movie is the music. I love the music as everyone, at least those who are still alive, jump into the lifeboat and speed away before the ship explodes. And I love the ending with the chanting and the creepy music as the camera pans through the water back to the burial site where we hear Stella Stevens' voice say, "There is a devil, there is no doubt. Is he trying to get in us or is he trying to get out?" That's that poem we played. I could go on and on, but ultimately all I can say is that this film is pure TV movie gold. In fact, when I put my notice to quit the video store, I begged my manager for the VHS copy of Cruising to Terror. Since I think I was the only one who rented it, she gave it to me, and yes, I still have it. Questions. Yay. Was Frank really the guardian, or was it the cat? Oh, which we just said. If so, the captain saved the cat at the end. I know this throws off the total total of souls on board, but I really wondered that. You know, I did too. And I don't know what the answer to that is. I feel like there needs to be a sequel.
Oh, yes.
More
Cruise into Terror. Yes.
Cruising
into Terror with Al Pacino.
So we have one piece of feedback from our friend Gore Blimey.
Hey, Amanda, Dan, and Nate. It's Gore Blimey here from the Trilogy of Terror podcast. It's not often I can get hold of the films that you talk about, but I've been wanting to watch Cruise into Terror for a long time and was really excited to get my hands on a copy. Sadly, it's a very poor quality copy. It's hard to see faces clearly and it gets confusing working out what's going on in the dark scenes. But I did want to send some feedback in, and here's my take on the movie. The cruise liner these passengers were meant to be on was overbooked, so they're being transported in a shabby old cargo boat instead, which they all seem completely happy about. Apart from the captain, a macho guy who has a problem keeping his shirt buttons done up over his chest hair and tends to do heroic things quite a lot. His appeal doesn't go unnoticed, though. The woman in a big hat flirts with him and wants to know more, asking for his story, saying she'd be happy to be bored by a long one. Now, Captain Andrews is often called Andy too, as in Andrew, so I guess his name is Andrew Andrews? Parents can be so cruel. He's a straightforward captain who likes things shipshape and Bristol fashion. And speaking of Bristols, we also have a couple of nubile young women who brought along tiny bikinis as a bit of light relief, for some viewers. Back to the crew, which is surprisingly just the three of them. Normally you'd expect a cruise to be awash with seamen, or maybe that's just the boat trips I've been on. As well as the captain, we have Nathan. He's a black guy who speaks in a stereotype accent, and I think he's the first to get killed off. And, of course, there's Dirk Benedict, greeting the passengers in his white uniform and making them feel welcome. A smart move. Dressed like that, I'd be more than happy for him to take me up the poop deck. Linda Day George and Christopher George are playing a married couple who still flirt together, especially in one scene when he talks about her spectacular entrance and tries to get her to show him again. By contrast, we have John Forsythe as the Reverend Charles Mather, a Charlie who's in touch with a very different set of angels this time, and his sexually frustrated wife. Even without her spelling it out, we know this because of her moments alone when she's seen sensually caressing her wincey at nighty. One of the other passengers is heard asking about the Reverend, "Do you think he's come to save our souls?" Well, let's say there are certainly a few our souls who could do with a bit of saving later on. The passengers assemble in the ship's lounge where they start figuring out who's who. This whole scene feels straight out of an Agatha Christie. Ray Milland is a professor with a theory about ancient Egyptians building a tomb in Mexico, which happens to be underwater near where the ship's route is. Things start to go weird when one of the young women, Debbie, is strolling on deck dressed up as Where's Waldo. There's a pair of red lights and a cat with a hilariously overdubbed meow, and she's so startled she falls over the side of the boat. But thankfully, is safe when she clings on long enough to get rescued. Luckily, it seems this time Waldo was easy to find. The next day, they avoid the expected stormy sea, and there's not even a big swell. Which is quite surprising since I'd just been watching Dirk Benedict greasing up oily pipes. Some of the passengers decide to go for a swim, and before you can say, "Doesn't that music sound a lot like the Jaws theme?" they're attacked by a stock-footed shark. Captain Chesthair wastes no time leaping into the water, saving the day, and emerging in his wet, clingy, half-undone shirt. Later, the ship breaks down, again, directly above the site of the tomb. The passengers seem strangely enthusiastic to go diving to find it, presumably forgetting the trauma of nearly being eaten by a shark. "It'll be fun," they say, deciding who will dive. The young women are particularly keen to see Dirk Benedict going down, and to be honest, who can blame them? So underwater they go, and soon return an ancient Egyptian nameplate. This gets the professor even more excited, while the Reverend starts to freak out. I must admit, I found it a bit strange how a respected archaeologist is happy for an ancient site of worldwide importance to be ransacked by a group of clueless tourists. I thought he'd want everything painstakingly measured, recorded and logged, but maybe I've just watched too many time teams. They find the sarcophagus and raise it up on board, where people say, "It's incredible. It's solid gold. It's magnificent. It's tiny. Me, I'd be wondering if that's not just an ornament for the pyramid's mantelpiece." Nathan gets buried under the rocks beneath, giving the captain another reason to be manly, jump into the water and emerge wet with his shirt bursting open again. The sarcophagus seems to be alive and breathing, which is actually a pretty neat effect that looks quite creepy. Characters behave oddly. The Rev's wife walks into a man's cabin and drops her nightie, before emerging shortly after to attack her husband verbally in Latin. This causes everyone to rush out into the corridor in a scene with so many wide open male shirts it looked like the walls had been carpeted. Christopher George's character becomes obsessed with money and is so horrible to Linda Day George, I kept expecting her to shout out, "Bastard! Bastard! Bastard!" at him. The professor shouts at the sarcophagus and swings an axe at it, but ends up falling to the floor, and a woman walks in to find it humping his head. Well, probably not, but it was very hard to make out exactly what was going on in the copy I watched. The Reverend throws some oil lamps at the sarcophagus and the badly dubbed cat, immediately turning the room into an inferno. People seem to return to their old selves, and his wife decides to stay with him in the burning room while the others escape in a boat, and the ship explodes to dramatic organ-like music. Cruise into Terror is a lot of fun. It's hard to take it seriously, and it's not remotely scary, but it's hard not to like its enthusiasm and campiness. It has a great cast, like a who's who of 70s TV shows and TV movies, a daft story, Dirk Benedict at his hottest, and it's all totally entertaining. And that ticks all the boxes for me. I'm really pleased I got to watch it at last.
So that was Gore Blimey's feedback. It was great. I'm so glad he sent that in. It was hilarious. I listened to it a couple of times, and I laughed out loud at some of his innuendos. Also, he has such a beautiful speaking voice. I was actually tempted when I got the feedback to ask Dan if he would just let us play the feedback as the synopsis. Because I think he did a really good job, like, breaking down the film and, like, with that gorgeous voice of his. Some of the things I made notes on while I was listening to that that mean nothing are that he also pointed out that the captain's name is Andy Andrews, which is unfortunate for Hugh O'Brien's character and pretty funny. Also, he pointed out something we didn't really talk about. We just sort of, I think, glided over it, and that's that the Roger Mosley character, Nathan, who is the African-American in the film, well, I guess he's the black guy, he's not African-American, and he's from another country. He's basically a stereotype, and he's the first to die, and that's probably an issue. In the 70s, like, nobody probably thought about it, but it stuck out to me. It stuck out even more because it felt like they had to drop in another minority so that Emmanuel guy showed up out of nowhere. I don't even remember him getting on the boat, the Hispanic. Do you remember?
Yes,
he just shows up.
I do, yes.
They're like, swab the deck. And I'm like, who the hell is that? So it's funny, but he's right to bring that up, that was sort of a... I don't want to say it's a problem with the film. I mean, I don't think the film is meant to be mean-spirited, and they didn't mean anything by it, but it's something that I think we look at now, and we think maybe... And also, I don't remember where he said it, but Gore Blimey said the word asshole, and I don't think I've ever heard him curse before.
He kind of makes it arsehole relating to... He does it in an innuendo style that could be taken as asshole, or maybe not, if you're not as, you know, filthy-minded as many are, like the cast.
Oh,
are we G-rated on this podcast?
No.
I don't think so.
Oh, I am.
Oh,
well,
you don't
are,
have to be.
You don't have to be.
Come on.
Oh, I'm not a good cusser. Wes is a better cusser than I am. I mean, I can if I get mad or something, but it doesn't come, like, naturally to me in conversation, I guess. I mean, I don't know why. I guess it's just the way I was raised or something.
Didn't you swear when you guys were doing the drunk cast of, like, the Halloween Resurrection when they killed
I remember. I was so mad.
Yes.
The only time I've heard Nate use those words is he was also mad talking about home invasion movies on an episode, too, and I think he used the F word. Or
those
shit.
Movies make me so mad. They make me so mad.
Do you look at the TV and go, how dare you?
Yes. I'm like, director, how dare you do this? And then usually I'll go online and somebody will say, oh, well, you just didn't understand the movie. And I'm like, no, I got it. I just didn't like it.
Yeah, I know. I hate that when people are like, you don't get it. No, I get it. It's just, it's got problems, you know?
Yeah, it's just not my thing. But I love Gore Blimey's feedback. I'm like, dang, he gave us a Dan synopsis right there.
He did. He did. Yeah, that's why I thought about just telling Dan to take the night off. if you're not familiar with Gore Blimey and you're just listening to the show now, and he's never sent audio feedback before. He has a podcast called the Trilogy of Terror podcast, which he does pretty sporadically. It comes out here and there, but it's really worth listening to, especially if you got a lot out of that piece of feedback, because that's basically like that for 30 minutes straight. Yeah. And it's hilarious and it's charming. And also, he did this Friday the 13th two-part episode with Eric Threefall, am I saying that right, from The Story Continues. And it's one of my favorite things that I've ever heard. I listen to it all the time, especially when I'm feeling really down. I always put on the Gore Blimey Eric Friday the 13th episodes into my headphones, and I feel really good. So if you're listening to this now and you don't know Gore Vlamy, go discover him. He's wonderful. The other thing he did that was so great was he yelled out "bastard," and it sounded so good when he said it.
Yeah. And he got all three of them in, which is awesome. Yeah. I was actually on. I don't know if it's the most recent one, but I was just on a Trilogy of Terror. He's doing a series of episodes called Short and Curlies.
And, yeah, that's right.
And I am on one talking short films. We talk six short films, and we kind of – I pick three, he picks three, and we kind of judge them and try to pick which is our favorite.
Yeah, so look for Dan's episode too. I'm ashamed to say I haven't heard it yet. Oh, the other thing that Gore Vlamy said that was hilarious was the Where's Waldo comment about the lady's outfit. That was really funny. Yeah, a lot of this was so good, but just to cut it down, I mean, we can say some other things after, but he did agree with us. He said it was like an enthusiastic – I can't remember what the other word is. I wrote it down, and now I can't read my own handwriting. Oh, and that Dirk Benedict was hot. I think we can all agree on that here in this room. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So did you guys want to say anything else about his feedback?
I did like
– I really appreciate him writing in.
Yes. Yes, thank you, girl. And I love the moment where he's talking about Stella Stevens wanting to hear Hugh O'Brien's story and saying she's very interested in being bored by a long one. Which I like quite a bit. And here's the thing.
I was too.
Here's the thing with Gore is that like that's a master class in innuendo. And even at the beginning when he says, and I felt bad that he's had such a tough time finding copies of these movies. I feel like he's a bit deprived or something. But at the beginning when he says, "I finally got my hands on a copy," I'm like, even that sounds incredibly filthy. And I loved it. So thank you so much, Gore. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope you send in more of these. I know the movies are hard to watch sometimes, so sometimes the copies aren't great, and sometimes they're not very accessible. But we do hope you continue to send in feedback, either written or through audio. And we hope other listeners are encouraged, too, to respond with their feedback, because we love it, obviously. So thank you, GB. And finally, going back to our last episode, Dave Brazil commented on our discussion on Smile, Jenny, You're Dead. I really thought this was cute, so I wanted to read it. As you were wrapping up the discussion of the romantic bedroom scene in Smile, Jenny, You're Dead, Dan said something like, "And then you have Zalman King." He was just slightly changing the subject, but for a minute I got this image of the camera panning from the bed over to Zalman King, just sitting in an armchair eating a bag of chips and watching them silently, which was really amazing. I just love that. I love that. So I wanted to read that. So that's our feedback. Thank you, by the way, David, and to everybody else who sent us something. That was really great.
Can I mention something? I'm looking at Meryl right now, and I was just looking, and because you said Dead Man Curve was the same night as Cruising to Terror, but then about a week before that was the Bermuda Depths. Ooh. And then there was a film called Night Cries, which I'm not familiar with.
Oh, it's so good, with Michael Parks.
Yes,
and Susan St. James.
Yeah. And then about 3 days later was The Initiation of Sarah, which is a lot of fun.
What an amazing month of TV.
Yeah, and then on February 1st, 78, was, I've never seen this, but the title I'm sure will spark something in your mind, See How She Runs. And all I could think of was, which is probably a great movie, but all I could think of when I see How She Runs is See How They Run. And I go back to the beginning.
Wow. Wow, see?
Well, you know.
Oh, my God. Look what you did.
And John Forsythe is in that, right?
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Oh, my God.
1964. Taking him back. Yeah, that's the first made-for-TV movie, See How They Run, just in case people don't know. That aired, and I think it was CBS World Premiere. It could have been NBC. I think it was CBS.
That'll be our last episode. Our last episode will be See How She Runs and See How They Run.
You know what?
We're done.
Yeah, I think that would be cool if we could do that. First, we have to find a copy of See How They Run. To do that. So let me just go ahead and briefly, since while we still have Nate, let's wrap this up. Our next episode is going to be a really fun one. So we're taking a little bit of hiatus because the next month for me is going to be really crazy because I took on a lot of projects that I probably shouldn't have, and so I'm really busy. And so we'll probably reconvene sometime in the middle of June, but we're going to be going just right into horror. It's going to be so much fun. So we're going to do a tribute and a retrospective on Valerie Harper, and we're going to watch Night Terror and People Across the Lake. People Across the Lake is streaming on Amazon, so anybody can watch it on there, and I highly recommend you do. It's batshit. It's really fun, and Night Terror is a classic. So that's going to be really fun. You can go ahead and follow us if you want more updates about our podcasts. You can follow us at the Made for TV Mayhem Show on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at TV Mayhem Podcast. You can follow us now on Instagram at Made for TV Mayhem, or you can email us at tvmayhempodcast@gmail.com, or just visit our site, which is madefortvmayhem.wordpress.com. Just briefly, I can't remember if I had announced it in the last episode, but I did the commentary with my friend Kayla Janice for The Girl Most Likely To, which is coming out, in June through Kino Lorber. So keep an eye out for that. That's a great TV movie. Also on the social medias, I'm doing a lot of must-see streaming TV movies. There's a lot of TV movies on Amazon, and I'm trying to dig them out and send links to them for everybody. And I've actually started up my blog again, and I'm doing kind of the same thing, except I'm covering a TV series called Insight, which was a religious program that we ran in syndication for 25 years. It was kind of like Twilight Zone sometimes, kind of like After School Special sometimes. And the people who own Insight have started uploading it to YouTube legally, and so I'm picking an episode like every 2 weeks or so, and I'm going to cover it on my blog. Just a capsule review, sorry for the motorcycle. And I'm going to do my trap cast hopefully before we get to the next full episode, but I've just been so busy. I have the script written, I just haven't had a chance to sit down and do it. So anyway, just keep paying attention if you enjoy the show. We're trying to keep things going as best we can, and in the month that we're not here, if it kind of ends up lasting like 5 or 6 weeks, which I think it might, I'm going to go ahead and try to post old episodes and just kind of like promote them. So if you're new to us, keep a lookout for that, and we'll direct you to some of our best episodes. Dan, real quick, what is up with you?
What's going on? Oh, yeah, Adventure Super Train is still going and going. We are, when this episode goes up, the Last Precinct will have ended, and there'll be a new show with a guest host whom you folks might enjoy hearing, who has been on the show before, talking about a show. And then it's still, Gore Blimey and myself are still talking about Man to Man with Dean Lerner, and Amy the Conqueror and I are still doing Erie, Indiana. I'm still doing 1 Minute with European Zombies, circa 1980, covering Zombie Lake and Burial Ground. I'm around about 45-ish minutes in. And Rockin' All Week with You, the Happy Days podcast, as of the day we're recording this, I posted episode 7 on SoundCloud, which covers The Best Man and Great Expectations.
I'll never catch up.
Well, yeah, you know me. I start yakking and I can't stop, and it goes in all different directions. So I'm almost done with season 1, which is cool. Yeah, so that's what's going on there, and I'm still writing my Henningverse book. I've finished the first draft of the 666 reviews, and I am going to spend the next couple months revising those, and there's a little bit more to write for that. And I'm just kind of hanging out right now with a couple of dogs, and Cruising to Terror is playing. Yay!
Yeah. Yay. Okay, Nate, what's going on with you?
Nothing.
Don't ever say nothing. You're doing the Hysteria Continues.
Well, yes, but nothing new.
Well, you're making new episodes.
Yeah, we are, and it's been fun.
Yeah, you guys are like doing it. You guys are going. Like, you're recording all the time now.
We have been, but it's because we're going to be taking a long break. I think Eric can't record the entire month of June, so we're trying to bank a few episodes.
Is that the Cat from Cruise of Terror?
What's that's going not on there? Is that that black cat? Oh my gosh, Nate has a black cat.
And so I think that's it. So we're just going to close out with more theme music from Cruise into Terror. And we will see you next time. Good night.